listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. In July 2019, Hawkwood held Seed Festival, an environmental festival focused on planting big ideas. One of the speakers at this year's Seed was Alison Tickell, founder of Julie's Bicycle, a charity supporting the creative community to act on climate change and environmental sustainability.
Okay, I'm Alison Tickell. I'm the founder of Julie's Bicycle, a company that works across the creative community, very action-focused on climate change and on our ecological emergency. And I'm here today. It's a real privilege to be here, to be part of the fantastic Seed Festival. So I gave a little talk about the work of Julie's Bicycle and culture and the creative community more broadly.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background? How did you get involved in the creative scene and then the kind of environmental world?
So I was trained as a cellist and a musician. Also, before I set up JB, I was working very much in a community context, training musicians how to work in community settings. And also, I was working with a fantastic jazz improviser, somebody called John Stevens, for years and years, really looking at how to develop an approach to creativity that was very community focused, very democratic, and really authentic. Then I started working in the music industry, and it just seemed that these two themes, climate change and culture, had a lot in common. I come from a family of climate scientists, so it was bringing those two worlds together.
I think arts and science are quite often put in like opposing fields. How do you find bringing them together?
Arts and science, you're absolutely right, they are often put in opposing fields, and it's daft because they contain that most critical set of characteristics that they share: curiosity, problem solving, the manifestation of how we are, seeking for truth, understanding, creativity. Obviously, the methodology is really different. The so-called scientific method requires evidence, and art, and it doesn't have that sort of that overarching constraint to it. But they're very similar, these two, which is why so many artists are great scientists and so many great scientists are artists.
Can you tell me a bit more about Julie's Bicycle and kind of some examples of the work that you do?
Sure. So Julie's Bicycle, we're 12 years old. We were set up very much in the context of recognising that in our response to climate change, we needed to do more than talk about it, and we needed to do more than just make work about it. We actually had to do something practical, active about it. So we started in the music industry, and we've now moved right across a lot of the performing and creative arts. And we do a number of things. We work with all sorts of organisations, big and small, to really look at how to develop climate action plans, which includes governance, creative commissioning programmes, but also energy management, hardcore nuts and bolts of really strong commitment to reducing impacts and rethinking what you do as an organisation or as an individual. So we do lots of that work. We now do an awful lot of work in the sort of creative and cultural policy space, so that policy speaks to these really big issues, so that we're not creating cultural policy that is irrelevant, but centrally puts it puts climate and environment as a sort of organising principle. We work a lot with artists, and we also do a lot of we've started to do a lot of training for creative climate leadership. Essentially, the short answer to it is we recognise that the creative community is an ecology of practice, and it's not enough just to use, like any ecologies, one bit of it, because the diversity will be damaged. So we work right across it on all sorts of different levels, which it creates quite a lot of challenges, but I think it's trying to do something a little bit differently.
What kind of challenges does it pose?
Well, we do a lot. So the team, I work with an incredible team. They are real experts at that sort of intersection between creativity, culture, the arts, and climate and the environment. It's taken a long time for us all mutually to develop those new skills and capacities. It's also, I think, people like really simple answers. What do you do? Well, I make T-shirts. You know, when you try to explain a bigger response, it's very hard for people to really understand it. But actually, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think it's important to try and do this, because what we are looking at is transformation. And transformation can happen in all sorts of different ways, but we need to sort of be proud of, recognise that that is the ambition. And therefore we need, you can't look at one bit without it inevitably leading to another bit. So, and there are bits of cultural transformation that JB does a lot of, and there are other bits that other people do more of. But we always look at what is required for the whole. And that can, as I say, it can reach across carbon footprinting right through to hosting a season of art, you know, and everything in between. So it's just hard sometimes to explain what we do clearly.
How receptive have you found arts organisations and artists to the work you're trying to do?
So we have found that has really changed. The first 5 years was an awful lot of nagging. You know, really sort of having to explain very precisely why energy matters, why your electricity bill matters, what relationship it's got to this humongous name, climate change. That has so radically altered as the sector, as the community, you know, civil society has become more and more aware. And one of the great exciting things recently that happened, I think, that was prompted by the IPCC special report on climate that was out last October, and has been a source of inspiration for the likes of the school strikes, Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion, is that climate change has been reinstated as an issue of critical concern. And we're all really happy talking about a climate emergency. Wow, who'd have thought that? So there's been such a major shift. And interestingly, we've been working with a lot of organisations for a long time because of the Arts Council has required organisations to do it. But there's been a massive swell in interest, not just in the UK, but internationally. We've never experienced anything quite like it.
You said in your talk earlier that a lot of organisations do work on climate change, but they don't talk about it. Mm. Why do you think they're unwilling to spread the word?
That's a really good question. I think that organisations have felt very exposed, organisations and individuals. Climate change, as I say, I think that it's become firmly part of the civic agenda in a way that it has never been before. There's been an awful lot of bashing around climate action. You know, climate action is complex, it's process driven, it's long term, and you can't do it all at once. And we're just emerging from an environment where if somebody, particularly somebody who's famous or part of the celebrity sort of world, makes a commitment to climate action, it's never enough. It's never enough. So we've experienced a lot of risk aversion of organisations or individuals doing some really exciting things, but not wanting people to know about it in case they get it's very hostile press. That's beginning to change just because the whole conversation is changing now.
Another thing that you said in your talk that I was quite struck by was that when you started Julie's Bicycle, you really thought like, yeah, we're going to change the world with this. And you then realised that actually, no, that wasn't going to happen. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it was like to realise that you weren't going to revolutionise the world, yeah. And how do you stay motivated now? Yeah.
Well, funnily enough, I think we can really change the world now, but this is 12 years into doing this work. And I think, so I came into it quite naively, thinking that just if people knew about climate change, then of course they'd all take action. And that we just needed to explain it and work with people to put in place a robust response. And of course, it doesn't work like that at all. You know, we know that knowing about climate change isn't enough. You've got to go through very, very kind of difficult, often quite traumatic personal experiences and embodied experiences to really feel what this thing is. And in the context of organisations, you've got to take your whole team through it, or, you know. So I think I was very naive, like lots of people. I thought if people knew about this issue, they'd deal with it. But of course, life is much, much more complicated than that. And also, we're contingent on so many other bits of the world that we inhabit. You know, touring, for example, the whites of arts organisations and individuals' eyes come into play when you talk about touring, because it means immediately, oh, we've got to stop flying. Well, let's take a deep breath, let's think about that and work out ways that we can actually, over a sensible and realistic period of time, commensurate with the issue, change how touring works.
What kind of things do you wish that the arts industry or the government would do more of?
There's a really good question. I think there's a simple answer to that, which is more of everything that we need to do. I think that it's a different question. Government and the creative community are different. So the role, I think, of the creative community is to do those two things that are JB's two key objectives. One is to transform our businesses and our activities so that they're commensurate with two challenges. One is a 1.5 degree limit on warming, and the second is the regeneration of our biodiversity. Both are intimately connected and absolutely critical. So we need to do a lot of modelling, a lot of experimentation ourselves, so that we can put into practice all the actions, big and little, that are needed to do that. And the second thing is to speak up and out. So to use our extraordinary voices to speak wherever we are, because we speak to more communities than any other. Everybody likes music of some sort, likes fashion of some sort, likes, you know. So we've got an incredible opportunity here to use our voices very responsibly to drive transformative change, to shape, shift and taste make and do all those amazing things that we can do. Government needs to get its act together. We need a really clear set of robust policy instruments and investment into driving a low carbon new economy with biodiversity as a key priority. That has to be done very quickly. We have to have a Green New Deal that's ambitious, that's doable, that's invested in, and all the policy and compliancy instruments to make that happen.
So kind of the creative communities need to both change themselves to be more environmentally friendly and also have a role to play in that kind of campaigning and activism as well, do you think?
Completely right. I mean, I think the creative community can do those two things. One is do stuff itself. Two, speak to its communities. But also the third thing it can do is actually lobby government. And under the sort of declaration, this a culture declares and architects declares, and what the one that JB's most involved in is music declares, we do say that we need to support government and lobby government and require government to put in place the infrastructure that we are subject to. There is only so much that we can do. We really need to work together, recognise that we're part of the wider world, including the economy. And so our, whatever our commitment is, must be matched and put into a context where we're going to succeed. And that's, a lot of that requires government policy and investment.
One thing you mentioned earlier was how the creative community can reframe the context that we're in when it comes to the environment. I wondered if you could just say a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the creative community, and I speak about it as a wide community. I said in my talk, it ranges from across fashion and broadcasting and design right through the arts into heritage and museums. So it's a very broad church. What it contains is pretty much, really vital touch points for all of us at different, wherever we are. We have a real role here, which is to reframe the very dominant late capitalist model that we are going to be happy if we have enough of everything, enough stuff, which we all know is not true, because we're not happy and we've got more than we've ever had. And it's breaking our life support systems and the life support systems of many others. We need to reframe what it is to be happy. What does well-being mean? Do we need to belong to a society defined by material consumerism, or do we need to belong to a society that is at peace with itself and cherishes the natural world? Well, I think it's not difficult to work out which one is going to be better for us and better for the world in which we live. So we really need to challenge this view of ourselves that we have been labouring under for, well, actually a lot longer than the 200 years of the Industrial Revolution. It actually, it pivots on a sort of hunter-gatherer moment into the idea, the concepts of ownership. But there's some really interesting modelling to be done there that meets us where we are now. You can't go back in history, and neither would you want to, but allows us to explore a different way of being together and being part of the planet's ecosystem.
Part of challenging the status quo and the kind of current way of looking at things, I think, is also maybe diversifying the voices that we hear from. And you mentioned in your talk the podcast that Julie's Bicycle's just bringing out, but the arts world and creative world is often seen as quite exclusive. What kind of things can we do you think, to try and get more different voices involved?
So it's a really critical question. The first thing to say is that I think the arts world, parts of the arts world, are very privileged, or perceived to be very privileged. Parts aren't. So one of the great things about music is that actually music is such a democratized, it's always been at the heart of social justice movements. So much exciting stuff has happened in music around social change since time immemorial. But parts are, and particularly the arts, the arts have had to work quite a lot on this term diversity. It's not a great term, but I think it's helpful because I think we know what it means, which basically means that you've got to have a much more representative group. Class is an issue, and so is ethnicity, race, how people are represented, who's represented. We really have got a job to do here, which is to people need to listen much more to the range of response to this. We need to recognise that there's all sorts of things happening around climate change, which might not always be obvious. We need to seek this out. We need to really democratise this conversation. Otherwise, we're not only are we sort of failing to tackle the issue, because this really is so much about democracy. Climate change is so much to do with historical injustice and equity, or lack thereof. But also, we have to invite everyone to be take an active role. When I say we, I don't mean JB, but I think that humanity needs to recognise that this is not about old systems of people having the same old conversation, being in the same old positions of power and privilege. And it's particularly acute around climate, where many of the people who are really suffering from impacts of climate change are the least to blame for it, and also the most easily marginalised. This is horrific. So we have to actively. I think we all have to actively recognise the importance of the social justice in its and ensure that what we're doing is conscious, and that we make as much space as we need to, which means, you know, stepping back, really stepping back, and also actively seeking out to redress imbalances.
I was just wondering if you could tell me about some artworks about climate change that have really affected you.
I can tell you one, actually, that really affected me, that completely, really moved me deeply, deeply. So there's lots of great stuff on. It's great stuff. I mean, one of the big criticisms that we hear a lot is that art on climate change doesn't work. Well, there's been three or four pieces of work on climate change that absolutely didn't work. But that's become a trope. It's become a reason not to do stuff on climate change. Actually, there's so much. From the sort of Richard Long kind of work through to the work of some of our spoken word artists like Zena Edwards, but I read a book recently, which I wasn't expecting. It bowled me over, called The Overstory by somebody called Richard Powers. And it's a book about activists and trees. And it's an extraordinary book, because what he does is he takes, as a writer, so he's as a writer, so he takes the subject of trees and what these incredible things are in a context of an extractive world. And he brings in we know more and more about trees, but he brings that science into such a moving life and imagination. I read that book and I have not looked at trees. I mean, it really has altered my view. So it's an example, a very recent example. There are many pieces like this. I mean, The Weather Project was the first piece which was Oliver Larson at the Tate. It's not directly about climate. It's not a sort of a science piece on climate. And I think very often, you know, that's where you are moved into a state of love or a recognition of loss, or just the sheer awe and beauty and wonder of the world around you, that art can do in a way that pretty much very little else can. Sometimes you get it in documentaries. But yeah, there's so much now. And I mean, Andy Goldsworthy is phenomenal.
As you mentioned, The Weather Project and now Andy Goldsworthy, can you just, for people who...
So Andy Goldsworthy... Andy Goldsworthy is an artist who's been making work in the natural landscape for a very long time. Beautiful shapes and patterns, exquisite, very, if any, non-natural interventions. And it sort of explores the shapes that often you see in nature. And they're in wonderful places. You'll suddenly find them. Oliver Eliasson is he's actually an Icelandic, I think, German artist. And The Weather Project was in the Turbine Hall. It's a very long, long time ago, but it was just a reenactment of atmosphere with a huge sun at the end. But I'm equally inspired by or enjoy, love listening to much more sort of activist work of, as I said today in the talk, spoken word artists are really, and poets are really where it's at the moment, and we're seeing more and more climate and environmentally related lyrics, plays. You know, it's everywhere now if we just listen, and that is such an important permeation into the big conversations. Selina Nwulu as a poet is another one who, she moves me to tears, her poetry. It's absolutely phenomenal. So, yeah, there's lots and lots and lots of great stuff.
You said that one way that people sort of take not take climate change more seriously, but understand the seriousness of climate change more is often when they have an embodied experience of it. Do you think art is a way of bringing that experience?
For sure. I mean, the thing about art is that, I mean, art, it's such a expansive word, isn't it? But you know, when you're listening to or you're experiencing art, you're kind of using different ways of understanding the world, and sometimes that's as an individual, and sometimes it's in these great big communities. I mean, you know, being part of, for example, this festival today, it's a gathering of people in a sort of sense of shared cause and purpose, and art, you know, the experience of the gatherings around art often do that. They create a sort of sense of shared identity, shared community, sense of belonging, and those two combined with the demonstrated commitment to actually doing something around the issue. So you've got your personal experience, your experience within a community, which is where you're, you know, your identity and all your sense of belonging, and then seeing how that really works on a day-to-day living practical way. The arts can do this really well. You know, it's the full McCoy, and when I talk about embodiment, I think that's what I mean. And it can exist on all sorts of levels. You can exist as an organization, or an experience, or as a person, or a, you know, it's that full and rich response.
So the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if there's a story from your life or a story that you've heard, it can be real, it can be fiction, that you can kind of look back on and think, oh yeah, that's really influenced what I'm doing now.
Mm. So many. I mean, from the sort of big story response is, you know, and it's also a little one. So my own personal journey on climate change, I'm sure... I think probably everybody has to go through. And it's a difficult journey because it requires losing one story and really understanding a different one. So when I was talking about metaphors and frames and narratives in my talk, that's really what we're talking about. We, you know, the story of us, Homo sapiens, in relation to both one another and the natural world, really has to change. And actually going through that story is a very, very, realizing that that story is not true is quite hard. And I suppose the sort of grand narrative is that we've all got to do that. But of course, it's most easily approached through small stories of change. So, and that's where people become very inspirational. So you know, there's been Rachel Carson, the founder of the modern environment movement, who realised her story of change was realising that insecticides were poisoning the planet. Then you've got people like Wangari Maathai, who founded the sort of Green Belt movement. Again, a really personal story of change, of seeing things differently. And I see it around me all the time with my family and with my friends and with my fantastic community at JB, that we're all reinventing or rethinking or reimagining our own narratives in relation to this huge other consciousness. So, and just to say, actually, I think we're slightly obsessed with the idea of story. You know, I often think stories, you know, they're very neat. So they start once upon a time and often they finish with an ending. And actually, I think one of the challenges we have now is to not think of it so much as a story, but think of it as an experience, a response, a really profound response to a different sort of level of consciousness, which is where, you know, language can be very limited, can't it? But the idea of really living and breathing really differently. And again, it's about really understanding and inhabiting love, because I do think that the big motivator for all of this is not just the end of the world is nigh. I mean, as people have said, we're all going to die anyway, but it's really about how much we cherish and how much we love the world that we are lucky enough to be a part of. So that story thing is interesting, but I think it also requires a... We don't know the end of this one, do we? We have no idea. We're not quite sure where we started.
Life is a lot messier than a story.
really, yeah.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. Find out more about Hawkwood, Seed Festival and Julie's Bicycle by following the links in the show notes. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy and her Cora, playing an original composition, Berta.